Before we induct our two living writers, I'd like to formally introduce the always dazzling jazz artist, Jessie Lane Powell. To jazz lovers across the globe, Jessie Lane Powell has been deemed a timeless classic voice. Born in Lexington, Kentucky, Jessie grew up in a home filled with gospel music of the church and that of her talented siblings. She followed her love for the stage, the orchestra setting, and jazz standards to Hollywood, California, where she was afforded the opportunity to open up for the sultry jazz great Nancy Wilson. After a few successful years on the West Coast, Jessie decided to bring her sound and craft back to its rightful home in Lexington, Kentucky. Her latest album is called Fill the Void. And please help me welcome Jessie Lane Powell and her accompaniment, Harley Cannon. Our next inductee was born on November 23, 1949, in Lexington, Kentucky. In school, several of her instructors saw through her shy exterior to the talented author blooming within and encouraged her to continue writing. After finishing at Henry Clay, she took a considerable step away from her hometown and the South when she moved to Connecticut to attend Connecticut College. She majored in English and was accepted into the Graduate Studies Creative Writing Program at Brown University, where 2 years later she earned her master's degree and saw her first play, Child Woman, produced. By 1975, she had earned her Doctorate of Arts degree in creative writing. During her years at Brown, she studied under poet Michael Harper, who introduced her first novel, Corregidora, to Toni Morrison, who became her editor. Her second novel, Eva's Man, was published a year later. She then began teaching at Wellesley College and later took a position at the University of Michigan. During her years in Michigan, she wrote a collection of short stories called White Rat in 1977, a volume-length poem, Songs for Aninho, and another volume of poetry titled The Hermit Woman. In 1998, she published a new novel, The Healing, which became a finalist for the National Book Award. Unfortunately, the success of her new novel was overshadowed by the media attention given to a confrontation involving her personal life. Just 1 year later, her latest novel, Mosquito, was published. She's not published since. Her work has been considered both groundbreaking and controversial in its approach to depicting racial imagery and confronting myths revolving around Black women, as well as in its investigation of psychological themes and oral storytelling techniques. Her life has come full circle as she once again lives in Lexington. Our fourth 2017 inductee into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame is Gail Jones. To read an excerpt of Ms. Jones' work, I'm happy to welcome back to her home away from home, Nikki Finney. Nikki Finney was born by the sea in South Carolina and raised during the civil rights, black power, and black arts movements. She began reading and writing poetry as a teenager growing up in the spectacle and human theater of the Deep South. She's the author of 4 books of poetry, On Wings Made of Gauze, Rice, which she wrote in a cubby at the Carnegie Center, The World is Round, and Head Often Split, which won the National Book Award for Poetry in 2011. For 21 years, she taught creative writing at the University of Kentucky and now holds the John H. Bennett Jr. Chair in Creative Writing and Southern Letters at the University of South Carolina in Columbia. And I just have to say, I'm certain you all miss having her in Lexington as much as I do. That said, please help me welcome home Nikki Finney.
First, let me say, no one can stand in for Gail Jones, ever, under any circumstances. Second, let me say that when Neil called and the Carnegie extended this invitation, I started having a daydream that I continue to have every day, that I even had today, when I got up to catch the plane to come here. And I want to tell you what that daydream is because you never know. So the daydream is I would get up from my seat and I would walk up here with her beautiful books in my hand. I had 6 in my daydream, but I only brought 2 because I thought it might get thrown out or something. And I would walk up and I would put the books on the podium. And slowly I could hear a door on the side of the building or the back of the building opening. And the door would open and I would look up and Gail Jones would be walking towards me. And I would slowly leave the books open and take my seat where you are. So because I believe in dreams, I've just let it go. and you just never know. This first excerpt is from The Healing, which follows Harlan Jane Eagleton, a healer. On a bus ride, she rides the bus, she takes the bus to get to her small towns to do her healing. I open a tin of Spirit of Scandinavia sardines, floating in mustard sauce. The woman on the bus beside me grunts and leans toward the aisle. She's a smallish, youngish, short-haired woman, small gypsy earrings in her ears, looks kind of familiar. I offer her some of them sardines, but she grunts and leans farther toward the aisle. I nibble the sardines with one of those small plastic forks and stare out the window. The sun hitting the window makes a rainbow across a field of straw pyramids. There's a few horses and cows grazing in the meadow, a whitewashed barn and a farmhouse, one of them three-story farmhouses, and there's one of them little tin-roofed sheds built onto the farmhouse. It looks like one of them painted scenes, you know, the sort of landscape paintings you can buy at them flea markets. Or the sort of landscapes that you see on television where the different artists teach you how to paint pictures. You can learn how to paint pictures in oil or watercolor, and they teach you the secrets of painting and make it seem like almost anyone can be an artist, at least be able to paint pictures in their style of painting. A Bible's open in my lap. I'm holding it catacornered, trying to keep the sardine oil off the pages or the mustard sauce. When I finish the tin of sardines, I drink the mustard sauce. The woman beside me grunts again. I glance over at her at them gypsy earrings. She's got smallish, almost perfect-shaped ears and is a little but full-mouthed woman. Most people like sardines or likes the taste of them sardines, but maybe she thinks I'm too countrified to be eating them sardines on the Greyhound bus. Even Spirit of Scandinavia sardines? Ever since I seen that movie about the Middle Passage, though, and they talked about them Africans coming to the New World being packed in them slave ships like sardines in a can, and even showed a drawing of them Africans, that's supposed to be a famous drawing, so every time I eat sardines, I think of that. Of course, I still like the taste of that, and I don't think she refused them sardines on account of that metaphor, though, because I'm sure there's plenty of people eat sardines and don't think of that metaphor. I deposit the tin in a plastic bag that's already brimming with paper cups, Coke cans, and crumpled paper napkins. Then I open a bag of corn tortillas. You know the ones used to use the bandito to advertise themselves? Till the Mexican-American people protested about that bandito, though I remember hearing a song once about a real bandito, not one of those commercialized banditos, but one of those social bandits that the people themselves sing about, like the heroes. You teach Sunday school, the woman asks, her head still tilted toward the aisle. Nah, I'm a faith healer, I say. I give her one of my brochures. I start to ask her whether them sardines reminds her of the Middle Passage, but I don't, because everybody, like I said, don't think of that metaphor. So I just give her one of my brochures. That brochure don't have no famous drawings in it like the Middle Passage, though. It just got a few clippings talking about the people I've healed, some of them famous, but mostly ordinary type peoples. She don't say anything and don't look at the brochure, though she's probably thinking a brochure commercializes the profession of faith healing. That is, if you can call faith healing a profession. I think she's going to put that brochure in that trash bag with that sardine can and them paper cups, Coke cans, and crumpled paper napkins, but she don't. She put it in her pocketbook. One of them Moroccan leather pocketbooks looked like the real Moroccan leather, not that imitation Moroccan leather. Of course, some people say that that real Moroccan leather don't look no different from the imitation Moroccan leather. Because the people that makes imitation Moroccan leather is more subtle and sophisticated than in the old days when you could tell imitation leather from real leather. You can buy your imitation purses these days, even Gucci, and think it's real. When she put that brochure in her pocketbook, though I see one of them paperback books peeking out. I don't see the title of that book, though it seemed like the name of some kind of insect, a mosquito or something like that. Maybe it's a book about them African mosquitoes. I know about them African mosquitoes and them Caribbean mosquitoes. I got me a friend named Mosquito, though she ain't named after none of them African or Caribbean mosquitoes. Her real name is Nadine. I don't call her Mosquito myself. I call her Nadine. And she's got a couple of them magazines. I mean, the young woman I give my faith healing brochure. I'm thinking maybe she's reading Essence or one of them type magazines, you know, for the African-American woman. But it ain't. It's Scientific American and Popular Culture. It looked kind of like National Geographic, except it say Popular Culture. I like that National Geographic myself, but them Americans on the cover of Popular Culture magazine with their tattoos and nose rings and sculptured and painted hairdos kind of look like the kind of folks you used to see in National Geographic type magazines. But now people all over the world look like they could be in them National Geographic type magazines and not just the so-called primitive peoples. She ain't say nothing about that faith healing, though, that woman with the gypsy earrings. But I know what she's thinking, that I'm some kind of charlatan and mercenary or some kind of crazy woman, all that. If I ain't a faker, then I'm a crazy woman that just believes in her own fakery. There's people like that. They're innocent believers or gullible believers, but it's their own fakery or somebody else's fakery they believe in. And it might not be fakery. It might just be other people believe it to be fakery. You don't always know fakery from fakery. Because I can tell she's one of them skeptical types, one of them skeptics. Gotta be a skeptic to be reading that Scientific American. Because ain't that the magazine of the skeptical? The gullible reads the National Enquirer. Or maybe they ain't gullible, but just likes to be entertained. Fictional science and popular fantasy and a lot of movie stars. You got to have a lot of movie stars in a magazine to interest popular culture. Maybe I'm a crazy woman, though, because there's been plenty to say I'm crazy. But in the small tank town I'm going to, they'll welcome me. At least those who believe. The others, well, you know, when they witness the healings, then they come around. Most of them, anyway. In my head, I've already got pictures of my destination, as clear and vivid as if I was already there. And all of them little southern and midwestern tank towns, they's all alike. I don't have to describe them little tank towns to you, because they're all alike. I don't know why they call them tank towns, though. Them little towns. I think they call them tank towns on account of them water tanks. You know them water tanks. Where the trains stop to take on water. And that water tank is always higher than all them little buildings in them towns. The mastery of language and writing for me in the Gail Jones's work has everything to do with stitching. And how you think she said it once and you don't think she's going to say it again, and then she says it 8 times, and every time she says it, it takes on a different atmosphere and visual description and meaning. And that was one of the things, the third thing I wanted to say is when I sat down, I did not realize this was the 25th anniversary of the Carnegie Center, and that, in terms of how things connect. I arrived here 25 years ago, right when the Carnegie Center was starting up, and so did Gail Jones back in town. And so there's a confluence of all kinds of spirit for me here in this building, but also being invited to read Gail Jones's work, whom I've never met, and whom I used to walk the streets of Lexington just hoping I would run into her. So one more reading. In my favorite book, The Hermit Woman, which is really hard to find, but it's a really important book to me because it's about a dangerous woman. And this is also the poem that Crystal took the title of her bookshop from. This is Wild Figs and Secret Places, and I'm just going to read an excerpt. Memory is a mosquito, pregnant again and out for blood. Memory bites through the leaves, stings the scalp, lucky to eat. I rub my neck with oil. I stuff my mouth with wild figs. Who am I? Who needs to know? I am merely a human woman claiming one of the earth's places, scratching the soles of my feet. Sometimes I collect my memory in leaves. Sometimes I hide it inside my shirt. I sit on a stone. I twist a blanket around my ankles. Are you afraid of me? It is not necessary. If you look at me closely, you can see my whole face. If I wanted, I could live without memory. It is only journeys forward that count. Time is a hard kiss on the jaw. I have been an adventuress in my day, an adventuress of the body and spirit. Sometimes I have worn bruises for lipstick. What do you find when you bite off the tips of your fingers? What happens when the same song is repeated? What exists between laughter and nausea? I swallow a mouthful of palm oil and rum. I am burdened by memory what I desire to be. There are a few men who have made me eat the back of my hands, or I have perfumed my belly for, but there have been times that I have worn my heart in my wrist. I will not speak to you of particulars. My tongue is a lizard disappearing, but I could make bells of your ears if I wanted to. The ground is hard here, but I know how to walk such ground. I know how to use it. Shall I sing for you? Shall I draw you circles? Shall I tell you the meanings behind numbers? Life is neither dream nor lie. I am a human woman, sandals strapped to my feet. I comb my hair. I massage my dark body. It is better to bite off the tip of one's finger than the tip of one's soul. I know the whole story. I already know it. So what is the use of repeating it? I eat wild figs. I bite off the ends of my fingers like cane stalks and suck. I make a necklace out of my own shoulders. I plait the grass for jewels to wear in my hair. My hair does not fall in my eyes. Sometimes I dance and raise my arms up high. Sometimes I remember a man raising my arms up higher. Sometimes I remember a man lowering them. Sometimes I have worn bruises for rouge. Sometimes I have said, look. Other times I have wanted to see without being seen. Sometimes I am a woman with pepper in my eyes.
Now our final inductee for the evening. I'm going to ask someone else to do the introduction. She served as the Carnegie Center's director from 1997 all the way till 2011. She was my first instructor when I took classes here at the Carnegie Center in the late 1990s, and she was my co-teacher in the nonfiction writing group for 14 years. Before her retirement, she and I talked often about how to make Lexington the literary arts capital of mid-America, including the idea of creating a Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame. And she has a very special connection to our inductee. Please welcome author and former Carnegie Center director Jan Eisenhower.
Nearly 30 years ago, a young writer came to Lexington to appear as a featured presenter at the 11th Kentucky Women Writers Conference. I remember this vividly because I introduced her that night as well. Her first novel, The Bean Trees, had been published just the year before. Barbara Kingsolver still had ties to Kentucky, strong ties, but she had ventured into the wider world. The setting of her novel reflected this dual awareness, part wry acknowledgement of a particular kind of life in rural Appalachia, part depiction of the sanctuary movement in the Southwest. The book imagined and honored new configurations for the American family. At its heart were compassion, empathy, and respect. The Bean Trees became an American classic, taught in schools, reprinted, translated, and read around the world. Launched into success, Barbara Kingsolver's writing career went on to take the shape of a vocation. "The old and honorable idea of vocation," writes Wendell Berry, "is simply that we each are called by God or by our gifts or by our preference to a kind of good work for which we are particularly fitted." Barbara Kingsolver found hints of her vocation at an early age when her essay describing the crumbling ceiling plaster at her elementary school, printed in the local newspaper, may have helped secure passage for a school bond issue. She studied ecology and evolutionary biology. She worked as a scientific writer. She lived outside of the United States, both as a child and an adult, observing and internalizing what matters to people who live in other places. The fruits of her vocation constitute a bumper crop. She has written 14 books, 7 novels, a collection of stories, 5 works of nonfiction, and a poetry collection. The Poisonwood Bible was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and was an Oprah's Book Club selection. The Lacuna received the 2010 Orange Prize for Women's Fiction, and other novels were finalists for that prize as well. Her articles have appeared in dozens of journals and periodicals. She addresses the issues of our time, her gaze fixed far into the future, staring down the consequences of action and inaction. The Kentucky writer Susan Christerson Brown says, "Art is a backfire." And I find that particularly true of the art of Barbara Kingsolver. She knows the power of a controlled burn. She knows how to set the match that robs a wildfire of oxygen. She pays scrupulous attention to her craft. Attend any writing workshop focused on craft, and you are sure to hear her name invoked. Study her verbs, the presenter recommends. No one does verbs like Barbara Kingsolver. Wendell Berry says that vocation enables us to look out for the interests of other people by helping us see how our work impacts their lives. We do not live in our careers. Our lives must be lived in a family, a neighborhood, a community. Barbara Kingsolver raises and preserves her own food. She has written about that experience with her husband and daughters. They support local farmers in their area. She knits, and she writes about knitting. She recently became a grandmother, and yes, she does babysit. And I expect she will write a book about that as well. She always knows a good book to recommend to a friend. Please welcome the very deserving 2017 inductee into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame, my old friend Barbara Kingsolver.
Thank you, Jan. What Jan didn't say is that we are cousins by marriage. So we go back even farther than our shared vocation, possibly as far as go-go boots. Thank you, Neil. Thank you, Mayor. And council and readers and lovers of literature, Lexingtonians, Carnegie Center, thank you so much for your love of books and for putting me in this. Oh, I didn't get to even look at my portrait. Oh, there I am. Looks like me. For putting me into this Hall of Fame, and thank you for doing it while I'm still alive. I can enjoy it so much more. And probably the portrait's better, too. As long as I've been able to think of myself as a person, I've thought of myself as a Kentuckian. And when I started to look for my voice as a writer, I tried out a lot of things because, you know, when you're young, you can't wait to kick the little town dust off your shoes and try to become somebody else. And the harder I tried to do that as a young writer, really the more awful my writing got. And I discovered that if I had anything to say that would matter, I would need to say it in a Kentucky voice. I would need to say it from the place I really inhabit, the person I really am, and that's a Kentuckian. So for as long as I've thought of myself as a writer, I've been a Kentucky writer, and I'm really proud to stand in the company of these and many other very, very great Kentucky writers who I grew up writing and admiring. And I'll also tell you, that is a job to live up to the name of Kentucky writer. I think about it all the time. I don't take it for granted that I belong in this company. It is work. It is a challenge because we're Kentuckians, a complicated lot. We're rebels. We're farmers. We're mothers and fathers and daughters and sons. We're steeped in, oh, what would you call it? A culture of politeness and modesty. As Neil mentioned earlier, we don't like to draw attention to ourselves. Oh, the very thought of having our portrait hanging on a 10-foot banner on Main Street, that is not a Kentucky thing. And at the same time, we are rebels, and we have anger, and we have things to say that need to be said. And we love our stories. So I'm going to tell you one little story, and I'm going to read a few, two or three little poems. Kentucky is a colorful state. I know that there are many different political positions espoused by Kentuckians, and I'm not going to assume anything about any of you here, except that you love books. I think that's a safe assumption, probably, that you have a commitment to literary fiction and poetry. So it's probably safe to say you share my feeling that nuanced communication took a hit last year. When the loudest, rudest tweet carries the day, where does that leave those of us who believe in literature? Who believe... Oh, honey, I'm just starting. Where does that leave those of us who believe in conversation? That conversation means listening. That it means a room is full of different kinds of people, every one of whom has something important to add. Where does that leave us? Here's where it left me in this dark winter, with a half a novel written, wondering, should I go on? Is there anyone out there who still speaks the language that I'm working really hard to craft? Yes, yes. Okay, thank you. Okay, well, in the middle of this dark winter, well, actually, not so long ago, I got a phone call. A young man called to ask me if I would be available on the 13th to have lunch with President Obama. I said, yeah, I think so. So this was just days, literally 7 days before he left that house, he invited me to come and have lunch. And
And so I went, and my husband dropped me off as directed at the Northwest Gate. And I went in, I showed my ID, and put my purse through the metal detector, and the very nice security guard said, "Now you just walk through that rose garden there. Go in the White House and go upstairs." So I did, and there were four of my favorite authors there waiting to join this lunch, and I had met them all before, people that I really admire. And a very nice butler took our coats and said, "President Obama is on the phone. He'll be right with you." And so we sat there, the five of us, kind of asking ourselves, why are we here? Does he want us to cheer him up? Because he might have picked the wrong five people. This is like hospice. Maybe he wants us to help him pack. None of those things were true. So then we were invited into just a little room in the living quarters of the upstairs of the White House. And there we were, a half a dozen of us, at a little table, a lovely little table, having lunch. Or I should say there we were, five very wide-eyed writers and one really cool, calm, collected, beautiful president. And we talked for 2 hours about our favorite books, about novels, about literature, about writing, about why we write and how we write, and do we use a computer, he asked, or do we write on legal pads? I don't know if we were there to cheer him up, but what happened is we got cheered up. He gave me a message that I know he wants me to give you. And this is what it is. I'm sorry. I'm straying from the microphone. This is what it is. All right. For 8 years, while he was doing the hardest job in the world, he turned to novels, to literature and poetry every day. He read. He had time to read. Does your dentist tell you he doesn't have time to read? Okay. President Obama found time every day to read novels because he said he went to fiction for guidance, for comfort, for wisdom, for the touchstone that brought him back to the moral center of humanity. And he said, "Now, I'm not the only person who does this." Imagine these really long, beautiful fingers. There are a lot of folks out there who feel the way I do. He said, "I have more Twitter followers than anybody on the planet, except for Katy Perry." Go figure. There are so many people who still depend, who depend more than ever on reading and writing. So please keep this in your heart as you read and as you write and as you go to your neighborhood bookstore and as you talk with your friends about fiction, because this is where we find our moral center as we do the hardest job in the world, which is keeping the faith. All right. I'm going to read some poems. This morning I was looking through poems thinking, you know, wondering what I could find that would speak to the times. Like "Smile When Your Heart Is Breaking," that spoke to the times, and I thank you. And to my surprise, I found some very old poems that spoke to the times, which just reminds you that the arc of the moral universe is long And sometimes we slip backwards, but progress is sure. I wrote this 20 years ago, almost. Yeah, 97, when I was living in Arizona and we had a new legislature that wanted to gut education. Imagine that. And in particular, it was just, they were cutting the funds for public education just again and again. And egregiously, the governor announced that we needed to cut poetry from the curriculum of schools in Arizona because it's just, you know, who needs poetry? And I thought, you can't just make poetry illegal. Poetry just is. Right? Poetry is everywhere. That's like saying the climate won't change, the globe won't warm up if we make it illegal to talk about it. Okay. So the day this happened, I started just seeing poetry everywhere I looked. And I felt very hopeful about that, just the unkillable nature of poetry. So I wrote this poem about that. It's called Beating Time. The governor interdicted, poetry is evicted from our curricula because metaphor and rhyme take time from science. Our children's self-reliance rests upon the things we count on. The laws of engineering, poeteering squanders time, and time is money. He said, let the chips fall where they may. The governor's voice fell down through Quicksilver microchip song, hummed along, and the law was delivered to its hearing. The students of engineering bent to their numbers in silent classrooms where the fans overhead whispered, I am, an iambic pentameter. Unruly and fractious equations were discarded at the bell. In the crumpled cast-off equations, small black figures shaped like tadpoles formed a nation unobserved in the waste paper basket. Outside, a storm is about to crack the sky. Lightning will score dry riverbeds, peeling back the mud like a plow, bellowing, taking out bridges, completely unexpectedly. The children too young to have heard of poetry's demise turn their eyes to the windows to see what they can count on. They will rise and dance to the iamb of the fans, whispering illicit rhymes, watching the sky for a sign while the rain beats time. This is called How to Love Your Neighbor, and this I wrote a little over 10 years ago, and it's dedicated to a beloved friend of mine named Frances Golden. She's my adopted mother. She has loved me unconditionally since the day we met when I was around 30, and she has taught me. She's in her 90s now. She has lived on the Lower East Side of Manhattan her whole life, the daughter of immigrants. She lives a life of pure, bold love. Now, as I mentioned before, Kentuckians, you know, we can be shy. We can be modest. We can have strong feelings. We can love strongly, but then we can worry that we might, you know, be making a fuss. Frances makes a fuss. She is a lesson that I've been trying to learn my whole life about boldness. So in her neighborhood, there's a mosque. And after the attacks of 9/11 in 2001, people were saying, saying hateful things about the mosque and about people who went to the mosque, about Muslims. So this is what Frances did, and this is just a perfect example of a Frances behavior. She took a big square of silk, about that big, and with a fabric marker she wrote, I love my Muslim neighbors. And she pinned this on the back of her purple jacket, which, and then she just wore that every day when she did her shopping, and she just walked around with this billboard on her back. And incidentally, when one time, another occasion, I was invited to the White House, I invited her, and she wore a billboard on her back that said, "Tax the Rich." So this is called How to Love Your Neighbor, and it's for Francis. All of them. Not just the morning shoppers, the man who walks his laughing dog, the couples with strawberry children. These are the given. Paint the word on a square of silk, much too large, pinned on the back of your jacket. The kids will stare. The dog may run across the street. Anyway, walk. Your shoes will wear out, and then your knees. Behind dust-colored curtains, a woman wraps her hijab, girding her heart for the street of this day. She will pause, call to her husband, "Come see." Finally, they will kneel at the window weeping. Mercy has 1,000 arresting faces, lightning bolts on her shoulder, threads of fire in her thin white hair. All right, go out and do that. I'll close with this one, which is called How to Be Hopeful. Always, always handy. If I could work whiskey into any of these poems, this might be the one. So you can read between the lines. How to be hopeful. Look, you might as well know this thing is going to take endless repair. Rubber cement, rubber bands, tapioca, the square of the hypotenuse, 19th century novels, heartstrings, sunrise. Any of these could be useful. Also feathers. The ignition is tricky. Sometimes you have to stand on an incline where things look possible, or a line you drew yourself, or the grocery line making faces at a toddler secretly over his mother's shoulder. You may have to pop the clutch and run past the evidence, past everyone who is praying for you. Definitely not directly to jail, but passing all previous records is okay, or passing strange, just not passing it up. Or park it and fly by the seat of your pants. With nothing in the bank, you will still want to take the express. Tiptoe past the dogs of the apocalypse, asleep in the shade of your future. Pay at the window. You can pass off hope like a bad check. You still have time, that's the thing, to make a deposit. Thank you.